Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Herb Bishop, who now knows where China is located. Welcome, Herb.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Yes, that was a good, interesting way of introduction. I knew it was over there in Asia, but when it comes right down to what which countries border it and where does it sit in relation to the sea and so on, it was a bit of a challenge. And looked on a map and all questions answered.
Now, beyond just looking at the map, Herb has also looked at the territory because he's just back from 3 weeks in China. And let's start with the first question, why China?
Well, it happenstance primarily. However, my wife Jackie and I have long been interested in traveling over in Asia and China in particular. And we happened to notice that a trip was available through a cultural exchange program sponsored by what used to be Elder Hostel and now Road Scholar. That's R-O-A-D. And we were just thumbing through some catalogs, and I happened to run across this sampling of places to visit in China. It was a little more than 3 weeks long, and it looked like something that would introduce us to the country. And so we decided to go ahead and go. And we did, just returned a few days ago.
Okay, and so we're recording this, of course, in the first part of May. So you were April in China. China, many people, many listeners understand, is a fairly large country, not only in population, but in topographical area. Were you in the north, the south, the middle? What was the climate like?
Well, you're right. China is a big country. It's the third largest country in the world, and there are a lot of people there. That's one thing that we first learned was that China is comprised of an ever-growing population, which is currently at about 1.4 billion. The reason I happen to know that is because there's a website that is live in terms of populations, and it changes as the population grows, and you can watch the numbers go up quickly. As far as our trip, the trip started in Beijing. We flew from Seattle to Beijing. And from there, we moved through the central part of the country and traveled by various means. We were able to sample high-speed trains. We were able to sample the regular train. We took a few flights. But we went to the central part, Xi'an in that area, and then we flew to the southwestern part of the country, then took another train over towards the west and back down to the south to a little community, and I use the term little cautiously, but we went to a community called Cali and then flew back to Shanghai from where we returned to Seattle.
And so you were traveling on transportation elements, trains, planes that were Chinese in production, or were you flying on imported gear? Do you have any sense of that?
I do a little bit. I certainly want to preface all my comments with a caveat that, you know, this is a sampling. This is my first exposure to China, and I certainly don't want to represent anything beyond our personal experiences. But yeah, we flew over on Henan Airlines, which is a new partner with Alaska Air, and that's a Chinese airlines, and excellent service, excellent routing for us, and we enjoyed that trip very much. The local preference for automobiles, we learned, were Audis and BMWs. There are Chinese cars in production, and they do import other cars, certainly Americans as well. The trains are usually, and I'm not sure about this, but they seem to be developed through a cooperative among a variety of international companies who are represented by countries like Germany and France and China as well. The three train systems that they employ are the traditional tracks, the high-speed train, which we got to ride a couple of times up to speeds of about 192 miles an hour, which was pretty good. And then the maglev trains, magnetic levitation trains, which I understand now hold the land speed record. And those get up there pretty high in 300 plus range. Mm-hmm. That's miles per hour, not kilometers.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so they bring in a lot of foreign expertise to help them with their primary objectives and development.
So that's nicely describing the area that you visited, how you traveled, how you got there. The group you were traveling with, Rhodes Scholars, were you generally with a certain sized group of people? How did that work?
They do have various sizes, and the particular group we went with was about 20 people, 22 people, I think it was. That's considered within their small group category. It was a full trip, meaning that all the places were taken. So we had the maximum number of folks along. The group is also categorized as an active experience, which in their terms means basically there's a lot of walking. You have to carry your own luggage at some places, especially on transport. And there's stairs involved and a little bit of hiking involved. So they want you to be able to get around, be ambulatory, and there aren't very many accommodations when it comes to particularly tourist attractions, which in my opinion was interesting to me because we found that I have interest in disabilities. And one of the things that I noticed was the accommodations for people experiencing disabilities were very targeted and yet not universal. For example, every sidewalk we walked on in every community that we visited had specially designed tiles to allow people with vision impairments to walk with a cane and know which direction they're going and when to expect changes in their route, which I thought was amazing because it's more than curb cuts. They do have those as well. We saw an article in an English newspaper, a China-produced newspaper, where a tour company, a local tour company, a Chinese tour company, was reprimanded heavily for excluding people experiencing developmental or just disabilities. They said that they would not be accommodated, and the government told them they had to accommodate them. That is in contrast to many of the buildings that rise up to 8 stories and are walk-ups and not accessible to people with ambulatory problems. So anyway, disabilities was an interesting aspect of the experience during that short visit.
So I'm going to cut right to the chase. The fundamental thing that makes us who we are, food. What was your experience with food over this time?
I anticipated that question from some of my friends, and my snarky quick response would be we ate a lot of Chinese food. But the truth of the matter is that the Chinese food is while it has a national character, it's very diverse and very interesting and very exciting if you're into eating different kinds of food. There's a general general guideline, I suppose, where in the north of China, the food tends to be a little saltier. It's dominated by white wheat, winter wheat, and buns and breads and so on. Whereas in the south, the food tends to be spicier, familiar with Sichuan kinds of kind of meals.
Right.
In the east, it's lighter, it's sweeter, it's more a lot of kelp, a lot of fish-related food. And in the west, it's sour due primarily to the preponderance or the minority groups that live in that area. Now, of course, all those foods mix together in various combinations. And one of the more interesting experiences was at a restaurant that catered to the American palate or tried to, and I believe it was in Shanghai. And they offered, along with dumplings, French fries and a variety of things that just on the surface didn't seem to go well together. Such a hodgepodge. But I was impressed by the foods. We did learn to eat with chopsticks. That was a utensil primarily used, which is interesting when you have a slippery food and you're trying to eat it. But the food was wonderful. It was delicious. It was well prepared. We always ate family style because we had a larger group. Except, of course, when we ate on our own. And in those cases, we had specialty dinners. And many, many restaurants had fresh food. I was interested in why many of the markets and many of the restaurants had fresh food, especially meats hanging there and so on, and even supermarkets. And the reason I was told is that the people like to know what they're eating. They don't like prepackaged foods like we have because they don't know what's in it. They don't know how it was prepared. And so they like to see the meat that they eat, which is not that much, and the vegetables that they eat. So a lot of restaurants had aquariums and fish and squid and crab and fresh meat laying out in on ice, and you pick what you want to eat.
So throughout all of this, it sounds as if there was a lot of pre-programmed eating choices of restaurants and so on. Did you have an opportunity to eat on your own, really on your own?
Yes, several times we were able to eat on our own. The reason the tour includes meals, there are several reasons, I suppose. One of them is to be sure to be able to sample the foods, but also to maintain the group integrity and the scheduling that they have. This is a heavily educational tour, so we attended a lot of lectures, a lot of time-specific commitments where we didn't see all of the tourist attractions. And that led to the food being prepared ahead of time. And when you think about going on your own, we were cautioned to be careful about some of the food stands in bazaars or in markets because the water used is tap water, which is not potable. And so they wash their food with that and are just cautioned that that might result in some problems. But on the whole, the restaurants were available. There are a lot of restaurants. They're everywhere, and they're all the ones we tried were quite good. And it was fun looking to see what we could experiment with and enjoy.
Well, the second classic topic has to do with communication. I'm going to guess your Chinese isn't at the fluent level. What level of fluency did you find in the people that you encountered as to English?
That's a safe guess. My Chinese is terrible. The hardest part of Chinese that I found was that the conversion to Roman letters or to our familiar alphabet is made with very few letters that they use. However, the pronunciation is always different. For example, the current president, Xi Jinping, his first name, Xi, is spelled X-I, and that is not familiar. So the sounds of letters don't correspond to our alphabet or our phonetics. The fact that our tour guides were fluent in English as a result of their qualifying to be tour guides in China, and they have very strict qualifications at different levels. I believe there are 5 levels of expertise. We had one guide. She provided support for us throughout our trip. She was with us almost at all times. And then we had local guides in the various communities. In the smaller communities, and again, I use that term loosely because we went to a small town, a small village, and it turned out there are about 3 to 5 million people that live there.
Oh.
But those folks, those local guides, speak English quite well, very well, however, not as proficiently as some of the national guides.
Now, images that people have of China seen through video and photography are two contrasting situations. One, a large population that you've indicated in cities, a lot of traffic, maybe some pollution, et cetera. And then a second view with some incredibly pleasant countryside, river valleys, and the rest of it. So as you were traveling, did one of those images dominate over the other?
That's a good question because it was so diverse, it was very difficult to capture. It's like traveling through the United States and being asked what characterized your impressions. And it was quite different wherever we went. I think a few common elements that I noticed include the haziness of the sky. We seldom had a clear day. Blue sky was not seen very often, regardless of where we were, whether the rural countryside or the city. I think that's something that struck me. I learned later that the current president is quite interested in changing that, and in part because he was impressed by the clean air that he saw here in Alaska. I was talking about that the other day, and it turns out that he has instituted a policy to clean things up that way. In the countryside, the other thing that struck me was that the ruralness is not rural in the same way that we see rural. We saw very few. I saw hardly any single family dwellings. People live in communes. They live in small clusters in the farmland. So the rural areas, having been populated for thousands of years, there are no great expanses. We did take a river cruise through the Three Gorges area along the Yangtze River, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely breathtaking, and yet it's not. You can't travel more than a couple of kilometers without seeing a home or a trail or a place where somebody has been and developed a little living quarter or even a little agricultural plot, some flat ground, some terrace or something along those lines. So the great expanses of openness are not as expansive as it might be in other underdeveloped or less developed areas.
So switching to something of a generalized impression that you could share, China has, as you've indicated, many people know, a long, long history, and it has moved into the modern world in a very accelerated way and is pushing at the edges of technological development. You've mentioned the maglev trains and so on. Well, what was your general impression about the overall modernity, if you will, of China as you saw it?
That's a great question, and it's a question that if your listeners have interest, they should really explore through other resources, because the Chinese, from what I gather, are very proud of, and rightly so, of their history, the major dynasties and the impact they had on the development of civilization, the great discoveries or inventions, you know, printing and paper and gunpowder and the compass and all those things come from China. And I think that history is embedded in the culture to such a degree that they want to honor it. They want to celebrate that. However, the great leap forward and the Cultural Revolution, that really put a damper on those things in the sense that changes were very, very quick and very rapid. After the reform, I think the country developed its infrastructure so quickly and so amazingly, it's left quite an impression on the young people, especially I noted this with a couple of folks we talked with, and they were, while quite proud of it, they were just in awe over the fact, for example, that in one community there was a river that had a bridge across it, and that bridge was the sole bridge, sole way over the river for years and years and years. And within the last 10 to 15 years, 36 additional bridges had been built. High-rises are going up at a phenomenal rate. And relocation, of course, is a policy that's occurring to help people move out of poverty. So when you look at a city and you see the hundreds and thousands of high-rise buildings that have gone up in the last few years, you wonder, how is it possible that those things have come so quickly? Bridges that are phenomenal feats of engineering and beautiful are everywhere to access various communities in a quicker manner. In the cities toward the end of our trip, particularly like Shanghai, I noticed that there the modernity is really noticeable in contrast to the older and then the ancient. For example, the people who colonized there, the French, the Germans, the British, they left their architecture, and it's honored and it's on display. But the Chinese have also created phenomenal modern buildings, some of the highest buildings in the world that are designed not to be affected by the high winds, for example, gives them a very interesting character. So the modern part of it has been incredibly fast, and we heard from the people that we had a chance to talk to that while everybody is in support of the great China dream, they also reflect some of the concerns that they have and the difficulties with that rapid change in culture and the rapid change in community. And some of them have trouble with that. And so China my impression is they're trying very hard to address that. And because of the political system that they have, the communist system, they can do that very quickly. They mm-hmm. don't.
Mike Malevsky, and I'm here speaking with her bishop. We've talked about China. He's shared some of his impressions from a recent three-week trip there. And you've mentioned the Communist Party. So how prevalent would you say the party's presence is? Noticeable in what ways?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that the party's presence is everywhere. Everybody knows that the party's in political control and in charge of the country. However, the party members are not the majority of people. They're not communists. I can give you an example. We were told by several of our tour guides that the things they're taught are quite simple in terms of what to avoid and discussion about. And the three T's, the first is Taiwan, the second is Tibet, and the third is Trump.
You have brought up the third. I'm going to walk back with this. Mr. Trump has elicited some strong reactions from around the world, a variety of places. How were you able to discern the Chinese feelings about our president?
Well, I from a handful of people that we talked to, our tour guides are exposed to, of course, tourists from all over the world, and they're well aware of the political realities. And their impression is that the impression that they gave us was that the Chinese are smart people, and they understand that, just as one example, they understand that the trade tariffs might likely affect trade. But an example one of the young men gave was that while computer chips are produced elsewhere, China can and does produce their own chips, and they're not, or at least he thinks, they're not that concerned about tariffs on things that they can produce themselves. And so he gave me the impression that they take it a little less seriously. They also expressed the transiency of our government. In other words, our policies are changing every few years in terms of time. And one of the sayings that they had, several people had, was that when there's a policy, there's also a strategy. And it applies in that case to both the external, which would be any U.S. policies that might impact China, and internal, any policies of the government that impact day-to-day operations or things that people do. They smile and say, well, we have ways of addressing that. And that's not an anti-government or anything, is simply that they can accommodate policies and they can accommodate things and changes. And so the impression of others is taken as not that important in terms of day-to-day life. That's so, the impression I got from the few folks we talked to about it.
Okay. Thank you. Now, if you think back to the time previous to your going to China and compare that to the now, would you say there were some ideas about China that you found changing by having actually been there, that you'd had some perhaps stereotypical images that you found to be not holding up well?
Yes, I tried to go with an open mind and limited expectations. Like I said, when we started, the first thing I did was look on a map to see where China was. I knew China was in Asia, and I knew generally, but I wasn't familiar with all the countries that border China and its position, for example, Korea's and to Japan and Taiwan and Laos. And that was the first thing. But what really struck me the most is that I have only spoken to a few people that are from China, and their impressions are based on their experience from having the opportunity to come to the United States or to visit other parts of the world where we've met. But the people who live in China and who haven't had a chance to get out, what strikes me about it in general was that there's such diversity and such a passion for life and for information and knowledge and experience. We went to, for example, a senior university, which is a school that is comprised of only senior citizens who wish to engage in lifelong learning. And the teachers are masters in their field, and they're instructors in music and art and calligraphy and history and all topics that are of interest. And the people that we met there, and we went to several classrooms, we attended a few lectures, we participated in a few of the classes, and they all did it with passion and joy and pride. And that was something I could never have gotten or knew about ahead of time. And I saw that in a way, being an educator here in the U.S., that I don't see in this country, which was a bit of an eye-opener to me. The other thing was the fact that the people live so closely together and in such large numbers that they seem relatively comfortable with each other in terms of public. For example, the bathrooms have, unlike this country, more often than not, simply holes, not seats for toilets, and mm-hmm. no walls between the places where you squat. And the people that I talk to that live in the hutongs and the communities there in the city, the smaller communities within the city, they talked about how important that was, because in the morning that's where the gossip and news is exchanged. And while that sounds funny, I'm certainly very uncomfortable going to the bathroom in public. And that was not on the radar before I went. Or
the comparison to, at least in my experience, bathrooms, large as they may be, tend to be quiet places where people don't talk to one another.
Don't talk to each other.
In the United States.
And, yeah, so those are little things. The communal meals, we did manage to have a few meals, three of them, in people's homes, which was interesting because we had a chance to meet family members and what they did. And everybody tries to cooperate. I found that anybody who was exposed to Westerners or even not, they had little projects. They'd either grow a few vegetables that they try to sell or make some handicrafts or useful items that they would sell to neighbors or to visitors. And one of the other things that kind of struck us was that we were asked by many people all over the place to have a picture taken with them. And that was a bit of a surprise. And we can only attribute it to the limited number of foreigners that people have seen, and they just want to show their friends and family. So the social character of the community was much greater than I had thought it would be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in the minute or so that we have left, how would you sum up an impression to share with listeners who might be contemplating a trip to China?
Well, I would highly encourage anyone interested in that kind of travel or seeing what's going on over there to go and go as soon as you can, because things change so quickly. The China that people saw 5 years ago, I have several close friends who have been there and worked there and lived there, and the impressions I got from them aren't holding up much anymore. And so the changes are rapid, and the advice I would give anyone is to go experience for yourself. Try to get off the beaten path a little bit if you can. Find a good interpreter and guide to help you that can explain what you're seeing, what you're experiencing. The people that that we've met all along the route were, on the most part, quite friendly. We were walking by ourselves through a park one day, and some man offered to show us about around and guide us so we wouldn't get lost, and I was impressed by that. And then all the great places, the Great Wall and the Yangtze River, the Three Gorges, the cities, the rural communities, they're certainly worth seeing and taking a look and experiencing.
Well, thank you, Herb Bishop, for coming in and sharing some impressions of a 3-week visit to China. We've touched the surface, so to speak. I hope we have provided listeners with some information they can use, and perhaps we'll take another look at some other aspects of life at a subsequent interview.
That would be great. Thank you, Michael. I wanted to mention one last thing, which struck me as well, is the heavy focus on clear values and virtues. So everywhere we went, it was pretty clear that there was a sense of what ought to be and the right things to do. And if you're interested in what those things are, please take time and go visit China. You'll see it everywhere.
All right.